As some of you may know, I'm on the organizing committee for this conference. And my job was to see to it that each of you was met at the airport and driven to your hotel. And I hope that all worked out for you. But so what I want to do is I want to thank the person who really deserves our thanks, and certainly my thanks, because I've done nothing, is I'd like to thank Remus for his tremendous help in setting up this conference. You walk it. Thank you very much. Because I just think, thinking for myself, my contribution was just, you know, all my name is there, but that's my contribution only. But thank you very much for both of you for all the work you've done. I really appreciate it. So I'd like to talk about comparison theory for E semigroups. Remember, we talked about E0 semigroups. Actually, I used that term first, and then Bill. Bill used terminology E semigroup. So an E semigroup is an E0 semigroup that doesn't have to preserve the unit, right? Actually, zero, I thought it meant to be supposed to be continuous, but now it means E0 means that it preserves the unit, and E just means that it doesn't. And beginning of this is just some recent work with Alexis Oleveris and Jeffrey Price. And basically, this is very, some of it's quite elementary. It's just to give you some terminology for classifying E0 semigroups. Also, later I'll be talking about some work, joint work with Daniel Markowitz. Now, thanks to Jeff in the earlier talks, you all know what an E semigroup is. The only difference I'm adding here now is we're just dropping one condition. E0 is one parameter semigroup of endomorphisms. It's weakly continuous. And if it preserves the identity, then it's an E0 semigroup. And if it doesn't preserve the identity group, you know, then it's an E semigroup. Well, an E semigroup is an E0 semigroup. An E0 semigroup is a special class of E semigroup where you preserve the identity. And all I want to do here today, basically, is just simply define co-cyclic conjugacy for E semigroups. And it's funny. I mean, it's a very simple thing, but it gives us some terminology which I want to talk about. Again, we've had a co-cycle. A co-cycle is a thing that satisfies this condition here. The only difference here now, again, the alpha doesn't have to be an E, can be an E semigroup. Okay, this is a co-cycle. And now, so a non-defined co-cycle conjugacy, and you've seen co-cycle conjugacy defined, several times, but the only difference now is that these are E semigroups. These are E semigroups, they don't preserve the unit. So these U's don't have to be unitary. So we'll say that two E semigroups, alpha and beta, we say they're related by an alpha cocycle. If U is an alpha cocycle, and now instead of being unitary, all we ask is that U star U be alpha T of the identity. Alpha T of the identity has to be a projection because it has to be a projection. So this is a partial isometry. And beta T of A is given by this. Okay? Everybody? So it's just the definition of cocyclic conjugacy. The only difference is now that we're not asking that alpha T of I be the identity or beta T of I be the identity. And notice that if alpha T is an E0 semigroup, so if alpha T of the identity is the identity, then this says that U star U is the identity. And if beta is the identity, then this condition here says that UT, and this is unitary, that says that UT star is the identity. So if we're working with E0 semigroups, The definition I've given is just the usual definition of cocycle conjugacy. Okay. And the next thing I want to talk about is a very nice E0 semigroup, iota. Iota T of A equals A, okay? That's the identity E0 semigroup. And the very first question we would ask, this is an E semigroup, and the first question you ask are, what are all the E semigroups that are cocycle conjugate to this? And the answer is alpha T of A equals S of T A S of T star, where S of T is an isometry, one primary group of isometries. So we've answered the first question. We've answered the first question about E0 semigroups. We found out what the cocycle conjugacy of the identity is. Just say as an aside, one of the things that I find, I just love E0 semigroups. One of the things really fascinating about them is after 20 years, almost any question you ask, you just have a graduate student who's just learning the subject or something like that, and he or she asks the question, almost any question you ask, the answer to the question is, we don't know. I mean, it's still a mystery. And almost any time you start to look into something, it always turns out to be much more complicated than it was when you started. Okay, so that's that. Very quickly, I guess I always mention these are very simple things, but I just want to mention, cocycle conjugacy has three important properties. Again, this is very basic stuff. Most of you all know this, but first, if you have an E semigroup, you look at, if alpha T is an E semigroup, then alpha T is the exponential of delta. Delta is a star derivation. That's the generator of it. And if H is a bounded Hermitian operator, and you form a new generator delta. Delta of A is delta one of A is delta of A plus I times the commutator of H with A. You can see that delta one can be exponentiated, and this gives you another E semigroup. And one result is that these alpha and beta are cocycle conjugate. So cocycle conjugacy is invariant under bounded pair. If you make a bounded perturbation of the generator, you get something that's cocycle conjugate. And the second thing is that if you have an E semigroup and you have a projection E that's invariant, so alpha T of E equals E is invariant, then if you take your Hilbert space H and you look at alpha T B of H E, you look at everything of the form E A E with A and B of H, then you can restrict alpha T to this, and you're going to get another E semigroup of that smaller Hilbert space, and you can see that these two things are cocycle conjugate. So if you cut down an E semigroup with invariant projection, you get something that's cocycle conjugate to it. Okay. And the last condition that's important is that suppose you have an E semigroup which is cocycle conjugate to the identity. So that is of this form. It's of the form sigma T of A is S of T A S of T star. Then if you form the tensor product, suppose alpha is an E semigroup. I have it here for an E0. I guess it could have been E. Suppose alpha is an E0 semigroup of B of H, and we tensor with alpha, tensor alpha and sigma, so that beta T of A tensor B is alpha T of A tensor sigma T of B. Then alpha and beta are cocycle conjugate. So to summarize, you can make a bounded perturbation of the generator. You can cut down with invariant projection, or you can tensor with something that's equivalent to the identity, and you stay in the class, the same class. And the name of the game, what we want to do is we want to solve the following problem: classify all the E-semi groups of B of H up to cocyclic conjugacy. That's the problem. And we're not doing a good job, but we're not solving this problem at all. We're still. In fact, this problem is the longer you. This is one of those problems where you're running the race, and the further you go, the further away the finish line gets. I mean, the more you know how far away the answer is. Now, so I've introduced this slightly new, mildly new, very trivial generalization. Instead of looking at E0-semi groups, we're going to look at E-semi groups. And do we get anything new? And the answer is no. Because, in fact, Jeff and Rex and I were looking at this question. We started trying to prove this theorem. We're working. How do we prove this theorem? Here's the question I want to ask. Is every E-semi group cocyclic conjugate to an E0-semi group? And we were working on this problem. How do you solve it? And you start working. It's a hard problem. And then suddenly we realized Bill's already solved the problem for us. Because you look at the product systems, there's a product system associated with an E-semi group, and you look at the product system you get, and it has the same properties as the product system, and then Bill tells you that there's an E0-semi group with that product system, and it's as defined up to cocyclic conjugacy, and so you get. So Bill's nice theorem that just solves the problem for you, by the way, every E-semi group is cocyclic conjugate to an E0-semi group. So we've generalized this thing, and it's got us nothing new. Why? And I've just wasted all your time doing this generalization. You know, why am I even doing this if it doesn't get you anything new? And here's what I want to do, though, is now we can define the notion of an ordering, of a co-cycle ordering of E-semi groups. And that's the key. I want to look at the ordering that occurs. And that's what we want to look at, is the order structure. Okay, first quickly, before I mention that, let's just quickly. Co-cycles. Jeff mentioned this. He gave the definition. There was a slight difference if he's working with E0-semi groups, but we're working with E-semi groups. If alpha is an E-semi group, then a co-cycle, a local co-cycle. What's a local co-cycle? Well, first, it's a co-cycle, and secondly, it has the property that C of T is an alpha T of B of H prime. It commutes. And you can easily see that the local cocycles are a cocyclic conjugacy. The local cocycles. You can multiply them, and they give you. You can multiply two of them, and it gives you one. There's an order structure, that whole thing is a cocyclic conjugacy invariant. So this is one cocyclic conjugacy invariant. It's just the structure of the local cocycle. The unitary local co-cycles, those correspond to what Bill calls, they give you what's called automorphisms. They get the automorphisms of the product system. Every automorphism of the product system, in Bill's sense, corresponds to a unitary local co-cycle. So that's that. Now, what's a projective local co-cycle? A projective local co-cycle of an E-semi group of B of H. If alpha and beta are E-semi groups, let me forget the first sentence. If alpha and beta are E-semi groups of B of H, can we say beta is a subordinate of alpha. Like I always use the word, not subordinate, whenever I use the word subordinate, whenever I'm considering anything and there's some sort of an order structure, subordinate is something that's less than it. So the subordinate, if you're talking about the numbers, what the integers under addition, positive integers, no, under addition, the subordinates of 4 are 3, 2, and 1, okay. 0, I guess, yeah. So if I have an eth-emic group, I have alpha T of A is an eth-emic group, and beta T is another eth-emic group. We say beta is subordinate if this difference here is completely positive for all T, and following Bott, we only need positivity for all T. So if this is completely positive for all T, then I say beta is a subordinate of alpha. And now, if beta is a subordinate of alpha, you just let E of T be beta T of the identity. That's a very simple thing. And it turns out that ET is a projective local cocycle. It's a cocycle, E of T, alpha T of S is E of T plus S. It's a projection, and it's local. It commutes. E of T commutes with alpha T of B of H. So it turns out that every projective local cocycle corresponds to a subordinate. And okay, so if E of T is a projective local cocycle, then beta T of A is E of T A, alpha T of A, you know, this. You just take alpha T of A and cut it down with E of T, you can put it on both sides because it commutes through. Then beta T is a subordinate of alpha. And there's a one-to-one correspondence between projective local cocycles and subordinates. Okay, so that's... Okay, so now... So now we define the order structure. Suppose alpha and beta are eth-emic groups. Okay? We say that alpha is beta... is alpha is bigger than beta. I should say Q. I shouldn't say dot. Anyway, I probably should call it Q dot. Anyway, alpha is bigger than beta in this new ordering. If beta is cocycle conjugate to a subordinate of alpha. Okay, everybody. Got the idea? So alpha is bigger than beta if beta is cocycle conjugate to a subordinate of alpha. And that's an order relationship. You can easily check that's an order relationship. Okay? One thing that's very nice about this, one thing I like about this definition is just a simple definition, but one thing now is what's the definition of spatial? What does it mean for an E0 semigroup to be spatial? Remember, to be spatial means there's a unit. What does spatial mean in this terminology? It's just trivial. An eth-emic group is spatial if and only if it's greater than the identity automorphism in this notion. Because remember, spatial, if it's spatial, this thing has a unit. Turns out that, you know, since this thing has a unit, cut the thing down with a unit and you get something that's cocycle conjugate to this. So an eth-emic group is spatial if and only if it's greater than the identity automorphism, greater than or equal to. What does it mean to be of index n? What's the index n mean? Alpha is of index n if and only if it's greater than or equal to in. That's the type 1 E0 semigroup of index n. And it's not true that it's bigger than n plus 1. Okay, so now we can define index term. This ordering is just that. Okay. Now, we've got an order relationship. The first thing you want to define is, first obvious question you ask, you have an order relationship. If alpha is bigger than beta, and beta is bigger than alpha, then are alpha and beta equivalent? And this is clearly, I thought this was, again, a trivial question. You know, there shouldn't be any, in fact, first time I showed Bill, he just said, you said, oh, that's, and I'm still waiting for you to give me the proof, please. Still waiting for that, Bill. it's not known. Now, what we do know, this is again Jeff and Alexis and I were working on the case. In the cases where Jeff was talking about, I have this theory called for boundary weight maps. There's this boundary weight map theory, a way to construct an E0 semi group from every CP flow. And by the way, the general theory I developed, there's one, the general theory has to be called, you have the Hilbert space K tensor L2. The general theory is you work on Hilbert space is K tensor L2. And the case that Jeff was talking about with K here is one dimensional. And I just want to mention, just as an aside, I want to mention that the theory when K equals, dimension of K equals 1, that's pretty well understood. I got formulas for calculating when things were cosine conjugate. Jeff and Alexis and I worked out all the local cocycles are. That theory is, there's still questions, there's still lots of questions you can ask, but that theory is basically understood. Given two of these things, there are conditions that you can compute, that condition that Jeff wrote down. There's conditions you can write down, you can compute whether or not they're cocyclically conjugate or not. And it's, up to the computation, this case is solved. And for this case, when K is one-dimensional, you look at all the EC, turns out these are all the interesting ones that you can get the type 1n, but that we don't understand. The type you get are the type, as Jeff talked about, type 2, 0. For that case, we can answer this question, that if alpha is bigger than beta, and beta is bigger than alpha, and they're both, in this case here, then this result is true. And the proof is the same proof. If you look at Nurian von Neumann's proof of the same question for factors, if you've got actually for a von Neumann algebra, it doesn't have to be a factor. If you have two projections in a von Neumann algebra, and each projection is equivalent to a subprojection of the other one, then they're equivalent. And you look at their proof, and what you do is you follow their proof through. And in our case, we have an unbounded weight. So there's a tricky thing. You've got to compute whether this weight applied to a certain operator is finite, and it is. But it's basically their proof plus an unbounded weight. But because you have the structure enough, you can answer this question. In general, Bill told me he was just going to produce the proof, but I'm still waiting for it. Okay. So now, what I'd like to talk about, this is again very simple. Just now, given any E0 semigroup, there's a natural cocyclic conjugacy theory, just a very simple one, that I suggest that whenever you, I would appreciate, whenever you construct a new E0 semigroup, I'd like you to produce this chain. So what you do is you construct the maximal chain. You start off with alpha. You find an E semigroup that's under that, an E semigroup that's under that, and you keep going. And these have to be maximal. What do I mean by maximal chains? What I mean by that is you can't put anything, if there's something between here and here, then it's either this or this. You can't, there's nothing in between. That's the maximal chain. Now, maybe there are E zero semigroups that don't have maximal, who knows? I don't, maybe the ones that will continue, I don't, yeah. As I say, almost any question you ask in the subject, the answer is you don't know. But for the ones where we can compute here, you can write down what the maximal. You can actually write for the case ones with these ones constructed over K tensor L2, where K is one dimensional. We know the answer. You can write these things down. You can write them down. And so, so for any E0 semigroup, the first thing you should do, I recommend, one of the questions you might want to ask yourself is, what are the maximal chains? For example, what about for the type 3s? Cyrus and Izumi were talking, what about those? What are the maximal chains for that? Their job now is to tell us what those maximal chains are. I want to coin a term. Over lunch, we were discussing, Alan Hirschberg suggested the following thing. I'd like to define something now. And he came up with a beautiful word. I wanted a word for it. Suppose you have an E0 semigroup, and it has no subordinates, no E subordinates. There's nothing under it. So his suggestion was, I want to call these insubordinate E0 semigroups, ones that have no... So an E0 semigroup that has no subordinates, nothing. There's no E semigroup that lives under it. So the question is, for example, those threes that we've just seen, are those the insubordinate E0 semigroups? Just quickly, why is this interesting? They are. It's an interesting question because of the following quick thing. Suppose I have an E0 semigroup that's insubordinate. If I tensor it with a 1n, with a 1-1, for example, that thing will have subordinates because the 1-1 has a subordinate. So if you have an insubordinate E semigroup or E0 semigroup, if you have something that's insubordinate, then if you tensor it with a 1-1, you get something that's different. If you tensor it with a 1-2, they're probably all going to be different. So these insubordinate E semigroups, if they exist, we don't even know if they exist. But if they do, but they have to be type 3. The only insubordinate E semigroup of type 1 or 2 is simply the I0. Remember, because for every spatial E0 semigroup always lives over I0, the trivial one. So if there are insubordinate, anyway, so one of the questions that comes up is, are there insubordinate E0 semigroups? Again, for maximal chains, I just want to mention, if you have an E0 semigroup of type 1n, since we know the 1n case, I'm going to do my job and tell you what the maximal chains are. The maximal chains are this. If I have something of type 1n, the only thing that's one step down is 1n minus 1. The only thing you can do is knock off a unit. And so the maximal chains for a 1n are this, or 1n, 1n minus 1, down to 1-1, down to 1-2, down to 1-0. So we know what the maximal chains are there. Okay. Okay, what about... Now, I want to introduce what I consider... It's hard to know what the simplest E0 semigroup is. Okay, so in this terminology, I want to introduce a terminology for what I consider probably the simplest class of E0 semigroups. I'm going to call these the type 2-0-0, 2-0, 0, 2-0. 2 zeros. Okay? What do I mean by a 2-0-0? An E semigroup is of type 2-0-0 if the only maximal chain is alpha I0. This is the index, is a type 2-0, so it has one unit only. It's an E0 semigroup, it has one unit and only one unit. Every other unit is a multiple, is a phase times it. And the only subordinate of this thing, the only subordinate is simply something of type 1-0. Okay. And the question is, Can we classify all of these? One of the questions I'd just like to ask you is, can you define any class of E0 semigroups? Any class, and then say, here's a class given by some reasonable cosine conjugacy invariant, and I'm going to classify all of them. And so far, as far as I know, the only thing we can classify are the type 1n's. The completely spatial ones, Bill's classified them. They're given by an integer n. But can we find any class of E0 semigroups? Write down all E0 semigroups that have some property, some cosine conjugacy invariant, and then classify them all. And this looks like the simplest. This looks to me like the simplest thing that we could do this for. The type 2-0-0. Okay, so repeat. So the 2-0-0 means the only subordinate is dropped down by what? Drop down to the 1-0. And 3 months ago, even I thought I knew the answer to this. throwing you the answer to this problem. And what I want to show you is, as I was writing up this lecture, I realized that I don't know the answer to this question. I thought I did, and now I don't. Anyway, for people working the subject, anyway, for me, my experience in this subject is that's the way the subject always goes. You work at a problem, you look at a problem, you think about it hard, you say, I see what the answer is. And then, like me, I spend 2 or 3 years trying to prove that, and then after 2 or 3 years, I begin to say, gee, maybe that's not right, and look for a counterexample. Okay. So I'd like to show you why. I thought I knew the answer to this question, and now I'm going to tell you that what I do now is much more complicated than I thought. And that's the way the subject always goes. Things are always more complicated than you think they're going to be. Very quickly, this is what, thanks to Jeff already explained, boundary weight maps. I have a theory, you look at what I call CP flows over B of H. The only difference I want to talk about in general, you look about K tensor L2. You look at maps over K tensor L2, and they're intertwined by the translation. What Jeff talked about with K has dimension 1. When K has dimension higher dimension, you know, there's a theory. What's interesting about the theory is when dimension of K equals 1, the theory is we understand that. When you go from 1 to 2, you would think going from 1 to 2 would mean nothing. You know, just already 2 is already much harder. I mean, I have no idea. Basically, to understand 2, you've got to understand all completely positive maps from the 2x2 matrices into themselves. That's a 16-dimensional space. Just ask what the completely positive maps from the 2x2 matrices into themselves. You would think that's a trivial problem. You can ask lots of questions that nobody knows the answer to. Okay. So just say that there is a general theory. Anyway, there's a general theory of you find these boundary weight maps. I don't want to get into they're sort of technical. They're maps from B of K. K is this member is this Hilbert space K. It can be finite-dimensional or infinite-dimensional. Generally, I want to look at it when K is finite-dimensional. You're looking at maps from the pre-dual of here into weights. And the weight means that if you multiply by this function, e to the minus x, that it becomes a normal functional. Okay. And these things satisfy a positivity condition that's fairly complicated. In one dimension, you can write that as what Jeff wrote down today. There are two positive ones. Just write it down. That's what the condition is this mapping has to be completely positive. This makes a simple condition. The thing that's complicated is you have 1 plus this mapping here. Anyway, this is a complicated mapping. You can write it down. But it's just say this denominator here, this inverse here really makes it very interesting. I just want to make it on the side. One of the things I find really personally very fascinating about this problem is that what you basically end up looking at is ordinary problems about positivity of mappings of matrix algebras in themselves, but because of this denominator, you get really interesting things happen that don't happen. You get a new sort of new questions arise that you didn't have before, and it makes it very interesting. I won't go on. Okay, and then again, using Bott's theorem again, when you from a CP flow, you can dilate it, it gives you an easier semi group. Oh, and the other point is that in this long, complicated paper that Jeff mentioned, I actually write down conditions. You can compute whether or not they're cocycle conjugate. What you basically do is you use Alan Cohn's trick. You put one CP flow here, another CP flow here, then you look at what you put in the corner. And again, it's a complicated question, but it's about a question. Basically, the question of analyzing what can you put in the corner so the matrix is positive. Okay, now the simplest case is when k, the dimension of k equals 1, and then you skip by a boundary weight, as I mentioned. This case is understood. Oh, just quickly, just to explain how the theory works, is the way you analyze these, the way you analyze whether what a, what, you know, the way you analyze the way you analyze whether one weight and another weight, whether they give you co-cyclic conjugate, E0 semigroups, groups, is you look, you form the matrix. You form the matrix that looks like this. Suppose you want to look at omega 1 and omega 2. You may form a matrix that looks like this, and you ask, what can you put here? And the question you ask yourself is, what kind of a boundary weight can you put in here? And this is just a bit of a functional. And again, that's how you do everything. You look at the corner, and you sort of that's how the theory works out. And it's okay. Okay, very quick. Oh, I will just mention here. This is actually from this Jeff. Just mention if one of these boundary weights is finite, that is, omega of the identity is less than infinity, then it turns out that omega produces something of type 1n, and you want to know what the index n is. You simply look at the functional. It looks like this. It's the number of terms. N is the number of terms. That's what the index is. Okay. If omega is infinity, then again, as Jeff pointed out, you get something of type 2-0. And okay, and then which one of these, of all these E0 semigroups, these are type 2-0, which one of these are a type 2-0-0? Which one of these are type 2-0-0? That is, there's nothing under them, and the condition is simply, Jeff mentioned, it turns out that the weight is what I call Q pure. A weight omega is Q pure if the only subordinates are multiples of it. And subordinates are that condition that Jeff wrote down, is that that omega t truncated divided by 1, anyway, it's like the ordinary condition that you've got this funny denominator and you have to evaluate. Anyway, it turns out earlier, if you can easily find out what the Q pure ones are. They are the ones that look like this. I want to look at the case when omega of A is infinite, or omega of the identity is infinite. When they're finite, if omega of the identity is finite, then omega is Q pure if and only it's pure, just pure. If omega of the identity is infinite, then this weight is Q pure if and only if you write it in this form, this sum. You can also write it in the form, the sum of is Fi A Fi. By the way, these f's, these functions f, don't have to be in L2. I repeat, the functions f here don't have to be in L2. They have to satisfy the condition at the bottom here. That is, we only ask that they're square integrable when you multiply, by this factor 1 minus e to the minus x. So at the origin, they can be a little bit. They don't have to be in L2 in the origin. And the necessary and sufficient condition for one of these weights to be Q pure is simply that if you form a linear combination of these vectors, you cannot get into L2. I repeat, you cannot get into L2. There's no linear combination in L2. So it's really funny. So it's interesting. So omega, the bay could be the sum of two terms, and yet the thing's Q pure. So you'll see how the subject is really interesting, because a state which you look at the state, you say, good Lord, this state is the sum of two things. How could it be pure? But the condition for Q purity is no linear combination is in L2. And it's easy to write down two functions that aren't in L2 so that no linear combination is in L2. That's easy to do. It's easy to do. Okay. Okay. And now, when I started, when I said I was going to, you know, talk at this conference, I thought I knew the answer to the question: What are all the E07 groups of type 2-0? I thought the answer is simply these are the ones that come from these weights that are Q pure. I thought that seemed to me that's the obvious thing. They have to be one. You know, it just seemed to me that was going to be the answer to the problem, and I thought that would be. Anyway, I thought that was the answer. But I want to mention this graduate student, Chris Jankowski, and he's been investigating boundary weights where the dimension of K is higher, 2, 3, 4, higher dimensional. But he's looking at examples where they're particularly simple form. They come from a simple weight, they come from a weight on the one-dimensional case, and you just sort of take the tensor product of that with a completely positive map. That's the idea. You just take one weight and you tensor the product, and you get a completely positive map. And the idea, well, I'll show you the idea. The idea is the following. Here's the idea. Very simple. I want to look at, I'm looking at K tensor L2, right? K is an n-dimensional Hilbert space, tensor L2, and I want to consider B of that, all bounded operators on a Hilbert space. That clearly can be written as a matrix, an n by n matrix with entries in L2, in, you know, B of, you know, L2, B of, you know, bounded operators on L2, right? So every operator can be written as a matrix like this. Again, my Hilbert space is just an n-dimensional space tensor L2, so every operator on that Hilbert space is an n-by-n matrix of operators in my regional space. Okay. And so now I define omega rho of this matrix to be, I simply apply my weight omega to every one of these things, I get a matrix, I apply phi to this, which is a completely positive map, and then I apply rho to that. Remember, rho is simply now a functional. It's something in the pre-dual of n by n matrices. So it's just a state on the n by n matrices. So rho, repeat, rho is a matrix on the n by n matrices. Phi is a completely positive map of the n by n matrices into themselves. It's a universal, completely positive map. And you just do this. So it's a very simple thing. And one thing that's interesting is that this phi has to satisfy certain properties. And Chris is working on that. They're complicated. This phi has to be completely positive, but it has to satisfy additional properties. If you just write down a completely positive map, it won't satisfy that. It's because of this funny boundary condition. It's a computable condition. You can write it down, but it's more complicated. But what he has found is the following. Suppose phi of A, so I want to give you a completely positive map of the n by n matrices into itself. Okay? And I want it to be universal, so phi of the identity is the identity. So I want a completely positive map of the n by n matrices into themselves, takes the identity of the identity. And here's a simple one. Phi of A is rho of A times the identity, where rho is a state. Okay? Very simple. And what it turns out to be is that suppose rho is faithful, that is, rho of A star A equals 0 means A is 0. So rho is a faithful state. Then if you form this boundary weight map, omega rho that I wrote down on the last slide, if you form that boundary weight map, that turns out to be Q pure. That is, we can compute the subordinates, and the only subordinate E semigroup is simply 0, the I0. So this thing gives you an E0 semigroup of type 200. And furthermore, you can show, the thing is not co-cycle conjugate to something coming from the k equals 1 case. It's not co-cycle conjugate to the k equals 1 case. By the way, this thing is slightly interesting because when you look at this function, when you look at this mapping is very impure. It's the opposite of pure. It's rho is a faithful state. It's n-fold degenerate. But yet this thing is pure in terms of E0 centered groups. It's pure. It's because this order structure is really interesting. And it really gives you strength. If you've spent a lot of time studying order structures and you develop intuition, when you look at this problem in this subject, Your intuition will almost invariably give you the wrong answer. I mean, in working the subject, I basically have to overcome the prejudice that I've learned all the stuff I've learned over these years is of no help. I have to relearn everything. But it turns out, upshot of this is that this gives you a whole new bunch of E0 centered groups of type 2-0 that we didn't see before. And I'm not naive enough to propose that these are all of them. I'm sure these aren't all of them. Oh, and for each n, by the way, for each n, distinct n, you get different ones. You get new ones. For every n, you get new ones that you didn't see before. So this index n is somehow an invariant. It's a co-cycle conjugacy invariant in some. And the result is that. What it means is simply, and as I say, I'm not naive now enough to assume that these are all of them. I'm sure there's zillions of others. I'm now convinced that finding all the E0 semi groups of type 2-0 is already going to be vast, and they're going to go on and on and on. Just that's what the subject does. Every problem turns out to be much harder than you ever thought it was. So I have a couple more things, but I think my time is, I have about 10, anyway, I think I'll just stop right here. Anyway, so that's my talk.
I might have missed something, but did you show us an example of a 2-0 not
2-0-0? Oh yeah. Just take the case where this omega is not Q pure. So just take. All right. Here's an idea. Just take something of the following form. Take something of the form omega of A is F A F, where F is a function that's not in L2, and then add to it G A G, where G is in L2. This is not type 2-0-0 because you can erase this one and you get a subordinate. So you can always remove if something finite dimension, if something bounded, you can remove it, and you get something that's smaller. So in general, there are lots of, in fact, by the way, I should also mention, what's type 2-0-1? 2-0-1 are things that are one step above a 2-0-0 and a 2-0-3, bang. So you have another index, 0, and then how many steps is it above 0? Exactly. Oh, there's no way, I'm sure there's more. But now, you see, you have questions for me. My question is for you. I want you guys to tell me whether there are any insubordinate type 3s. That would be nice to know, whether there's an insubordinate type 3. Okay. So that's your question to answer. Okay.
The
way this thing turned out. When I first. Chris started looking at this, and I sort of had turned it over and had to look at it. My gut reaction was at first, I thought, these things aren't going to be, these aren't going to be type 2-0 because, this thing is grossly not pure. But it is. It's because and the answer is simply the reason you can't find why there's no corner between this and the one-dimensional case is because there's sort of because if you did you have to go from a scalar to a suppose you go from a 1 to a 2. Well, a 2 is a C2 is a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and and C is 1. There's no way to map from C1 into C2 that doesn't pick out a direction. And you sort of, I mean, there's a computation you have to do, but but that's sort of what it is. There's no way to map C1 into C2 without in a rotationally invariant way, and there's no way to map C2 into C3 in a rotationally invariant. There's just no way to do it because it's just dimensions. But again, as I repeat, the thing that I find, as I say, constantly finds me so interesting about the thing is that because we have this Q ordering, that denominator, remember that denominator I had, that denominator just turns questions. I mean, again, it counters your intuition. I mean, as I said, I'm basically working the subject. You have to relearn your intuition because your ordinary intuition gives you the wrong answer almost every time. But anyway, you have to. Yeah. Okay. The way you
determine whether or not two cosines,
that's Alan Cohen's the trick about cocycle conjugacy. The way you figure that out is this trick of Alan Cohen's. You look, you have one thing here, and what you can put it's the corner. It's just the idea. That's the standard. By the way, that's just in general. In other words, if you want to study all E0 semigroups. Of all E0 semigroups of type where K is n-dimensional, and you want to understand them up to cocycle conjugacy, in order to understand that problem, you have to understand the problem of what are all the ones of K twice as big, because you have to know what the corners are. I mean, of a certain kind. I mean, so in other words, in order to understand cocycle conjugacy, you always have to move up to the Hilbert space has twice as many dimensions because you have to look at those corners. It's not as bad as looking at all of them because you only have to look at a certain kind. But it's anyway. But that's the trick. It's the trick of Alan Cohen on looking at cocycle conjugacy. Yes.